Good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us tonight on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV for our new and exciting Pick Me a Story series, where you'll embark on a journey through the pages of different stories read aloud by featured librarians from the Powell County Public Library. You can tune in live right here on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV, listen online or on demand at listenlikealocal.com with our free mobile app from the Google Play or App Store or on Apple Podcast. My name is Kelly Ward, and I am the Teen and Adult Services Librarian at the Powell County Public Library. I'll be reading all kinds of different books to you from different genres, like sci-fi and fantasy, westerns, mysteries, and more. Be healthy at home with the whole family and enjoy the storytelling service provided by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV and the Powell County Public Library. Pick Me a Story will be every Thursday at 6 o'clock p.m. right here on your hometown station, and we're so excited you can join us tonight. Let's get started. Before we get started with tonight's show, I've got some poems I would like to read to you from the Powell County Public Library's first ever National Poetry Month contest, which was held last month in April. We had entries from teens and adults in the community, and it's my honor to share each of these poems with you tonight on Pick Me a Story. The first poem is called Flashback to Nothing by Isadora Wise, who is a ninth grader at Powell County High School and lives in Clay City. I do not hate anyone. Hate is a disease. Schools were divided by racism. Make this world a little bit better. I was transported to Auschwitz, never, never to see my family again. I like to survive. 1 million were murdered at Auschwitz, sent through the chimney to the sky. Take time to be happy and enjoy life. Make this world a little bit better. The roads littered with trucks and bodies. Eddie, you are going to die today. Make this world a little bit better. Their eyes were gouged out. They were left on the side of the road. You learned not to scream. They can't eliminate a whole race. It's impossible. The end. This next poem is also by Isadora Wise. This is called Death Row Asylum. White walls surrounding. No way in, no way out. Only one way of knowing. Am I crazy or contagious? I see these people looking outside my door. Looking in like I'm a monkey in a cage. They take notes determining my future. Slowly, I go insane. There's no way of knowing what they are saying. All you can figure out is most likely you're stuck for good. And when the doctor comes in, his pain-driven face is the last thing you see before going to sleep. When you wake up, you're in a padded room. No way in. No way out. Slowly and surely, you come to focus. Finally, you see your destiny. Soon the doctor comes back in, but with a businessman, followed by chains. He gives you the final shot. Maybe, if I hadn't killed that family, I wouldn't be asleep. But instead, I would be here with you. Be the end. This next poem is written by Nicole Johnson, 27 years old, from Stanton. This is called Happiness Is You. Happiness was sitting in the old worn-down recliner in my grandparents' sunroom, while slowly drifting off to sleep with one foot sticking out from under a hand-stitched quilt. Fighting sleep with heavy eyes because I was reading through a new poetry book. Happiness used to be sitting shotgun in a car with the windows down while the wind kissed my cheek before flirtatiously grazing my hair. Not even hearing my own thoughts, the music played so loud in the background. Happiness used to be pumpkin lattes in the fall while sitting on the front porch and watching the leaves fight to hold on to the trees that wanted nothing more than to shed them. Not knowing, of course, that next year they would return, rested, and not so frail and fragile. Happiness was watching the rain fall from the window above my sink and lighting a candle when the sky became too heavy to hold the sun. Happiness used to be all that, but now happiness is you. The end. This next poem is also by Nicole Johnson. This is called Cold Hard Truth. I've never been too good at letting myself get attached. My heart is a tattered mess that no one can patch. Here's the cold, hard truth. Guess I had given up before I found you. Decided to open the window and let some fresh air in. Can't remember the last time I felt, but I'm beginning to feel again. Can't remember what warmth was or if I ever even knew. Guess that was before I met you. The darkest corners of my mind are beginning to thaw themselves out. Seeds of hope in my heart are now starting to sprout. Can't remember what being safe was, or if I ever even knew. Guess that was before I loved you. The end. This next poem is by Marilyn Barnett from Clay City. This is called Empty Houses. There stands what's left of an old house, abandoned, worthless, over time. A simple, fleeting image as I pass. Please don't forget me, it asks. Its porch frames the worn-out face of everything about this place. Windows, darkened and shattered, peer out across unplanted grass as if begging for a slight glance. A single door stands ajar, swinging in a broken leer, whispering, "No one you see is living here." Four walls lean slightly in, fallen and crushed against winds too strong to bear. A sloped roof holds singed shingles slightly curling upward toward a cloudless sky. Inside sits all the rest of what's left. An empty house shrinking away, all undone by only the simple absence of life. The end. This next poem is also by Marilyn Barnett. It is called The Hourglass. In the beginning, I didn't notice its shape or what it held. There was so much room back then, and I, not knowing my boundaries, moved freely from left to right, going here and going there. Now I'm pressed here in the middle. My space is narrow. Everybody is busy, sliding past to disappear, going somewhere, I fear. I don't know how much time I have left before I have to let go, landing on whatever is below. I look up and see all that came before, at least what I remember. Could it be what falls past are memories? Are they mine or his? I reach out and feel the sides. I try gripping with both hands. I don't want to slip through, for I have much to do. Maybe I can stay here, hang on, slow down, prepare him, prepare me. I don't want to look down. I don't want to see where I'm going. But yet, I must look ahead. That's different, right? I take time and think. At least I didn't go early. I must have been on the top when all this began. My hands have weakened. I can't reach the sides. They're further away. I'm falling down. My feet, then legs. I'm swallowed. All the way up to my outstretched arms. It's sudden then. It's over. Around me is everything and everybody, almost. I rest a bit and wake. I feel sprinkling from above. He's finally here, smiling and talking as if he always had. I'm glad, but we only have so many hours. Everything spins. We're looking down. It begins again. The end. This is another poem by Marilyn Barnett. This is called Last Rose. Last rose, heavy with raindrops, clinging to your beautiful, perfect petals on a sunless day. I see your struggle to bloom. Last rose, maybe you'll find your way in the glow of the midnight moon. The end. This last poem tonight is called Pumpkin Pete by Rick S. Johnson, who's 22, from Stanton, Kentucky. Whenever you hear a frightened shriek echoing through fields of corn and wheat, and people with faces as white as sheets, especially if near the woods to the east, go across those fields for a day and a half, and you'll see a gorgeous pumpkin patch. With pumpkins big, small, tall, and round, in the richest, softest, and most fertile ground. A cool, soft breeze right over your head. Those pumpkins might be good to bake into bread. You'll obviously think it, but don't say it aloud, because he'll be there when you turn around. If you don't want to ever be found, try to stay close to the ground. Go hide and sit behind the weeds. And don't touch the pumpkins, not even a leaf. If you're quiet enough and start listening, you'll start to hear them talking. But if you go there in the fall or spring, you might even hear those pumpkins sing. Swinging, screaming Pumpkin Pete, looking out from atop his broken tree. In his gaze, you'd rather not be, for your darkest fears he will soon see, and herd you in and make you scream. Try to pick us, and you will see why they call him the Reaper of in the East. Flee, all scoundrels and fools unwise. Better run, or you'll hear the sound of his scythe. How I know this, I've been there, I've seen him myself. From behind the corn stalks, he came right at me. A swinging, screaming pumpkin, as the song said. The scariest pumpkin I ever did see. His scream was blood-curdling, 'twas full of pain and sorrow. His eyes all jagged, as were of soulless, pitch-black and hollow. I knew then my trip there was horribly unwise, after I dodged a direct blow from his scythe. There were two friends who came with me that day. I thought I was the only one to escape, until I saw them asleep in front of the field the next day. As I arrived, I saw him lay them out. Then he turned my way. I finally got a good look of him. Now he looks like he can't scare a fly. I thought to myself, is this the same guy from last night? 3'6" tall, with a different face. A face with eyes not jagged, but in a more rounder shape. Cut-off jeans and a regular-sized brown hooded sweatshirt belted up with spare shoelace. And topping it all off, tied around his neck, as well as under where it overlapped his stained gloves, an old, torn burlap cape. It's been a year since that horrifying night and day, those life-changing events in late April, early May. He warned me in a less frightening but more subtle kind of way. A warning I now repeat from him to me and from him to you. So here it goes, the warning he did say. Don't worry, I won't be making you read this all day. Whenever you hear a frightened shriek echoing through fields of corn and wheat, and people with faces as white as sheets, don't go near the woods in the east, or you'll have a meet and greet with Pumpkin Pete. The end. I hope you enjoyed all of these amazing poems written by folks here in Powell County. If you'd like to read them again, just go to the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page. We'll be back with Pick Me a Story and get started with our sci-fi reads right after this short break.
104.9.
Preset us on your radio.
WSKV. Tune in on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9.
Online, live, or on demand at listenlikealocal.com.
With your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store, or on Apple Podcasts for the Pick Your Own Adventure series, where you and you alone are in charge of what happens in the journey. Danger, choice, adventure, and consequence. Are you prepared? The wrong decision could end a disaster, or worse. Live listeners can choose your path by texting WSKV in real time to 606-663-2811. The first text will control the next choice. Text 606-663-2811 during Pick Your Own Adventure and see how your stories unfold.
There are simple things Kentuckians can do to avoid COVID-19. Wash your hands often with soap and water. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Disinfect frequently touched surfaces. And avoid sick people. Find the facts at kycovid19.ky.gov. Because we're all part of Team Kentucky.
This message brought to you by Pickup Country, 104.9 WSKV.
Last week we started the sci-fi short story, Brightness Falls from the Air, by Margaret St. Clair, which is a love story about a man and a woman who is actually part of the bird people race, the Nyaiir. In this story, mankind has enslaved different alien species and subjected them to reality TV, life or death battles for amusement. Our hero, Care, is hopeful the human race will change, but Raisha, a Nyaiir, who is enslaved to these battles, thinks otherwise. Though we started the story at the end of last week's show, I'll start it over from the beginning tonight, since we didn't get very far. I hope you enjoy it. Brightness Falls from the Air, by Margaret St. Clair. Care used to go into the tepidarium of the Identification Bureau to practice singing. The tepidarium was a big room, filled almost from wall to wall by the pool of glittering preservative, and he liked its acoustics. The bodies of the bird people would drift a little back and forth in the pellucid fluid as he sang, and he liked to look at them. If the tepidarium was a little morbid as a place to practice singing, it was, Kerr used to think, no more morbid than the rest of the world in which he was living. When he had sung for as long as he thought good for his voice, he had no teacher. He would go to one of the windows and watch the luminous trails that meant the bird people were fighting again. The trails would float down slowly against the night sky as if they were made of stardust. But after Care met Raisha, he stopped all that. Raisha came to the bureau one evening just as he was going on duty. She had come to claim a body. The bodies of the bird people often stayed in the bureau for a considerable time. Ordinary means of transportation were forbidden to the bird people because of their extraterrestrial origin, and it was hard for them to get to the bureau to identify their dead. Raisha made the identification. It was her brother, paid the bureau's fee from a worn purse, and indicated on the proper form the disposal she wanted made of the body. She was quiet and controlled in her grief. Care had watched the televised battles of the bird people once or twice, but this was the first time he had ever seen one of them alive and face to face. He looked at her with interest and curiosity, and then with wonder and delight. The most striking thing about Raisha was her glowing, deep, turquoise plumage. It covered her from head to heels in what appeared to be a clinging velvet cloak. The coloring was so much more intense than that of the bodies in the tepidarium that Care would have thought she belonged to a different species than they. Her face, under the golden topknot, was quite human, and so were her slender, leaf-shaped hands. But there was a fantastic, light-boned grace in her movements, such as no human being ever had. Her voice was low, with a cello's fullness of tone. Everything about her, Care thought, was rare and delightful and curious. But there was a shadow in her face, as if a natural gaiety had been repressed by the overwhelming harshness of circumstance. "Where shall I have the ashes sent?" Care asked as he took the form. She plucked indecisively at her pink lower lip. "I am not sure. The manager where we are staying has told us we must leave tonight, and I do not know where we will go." Could I come back again to the bureau when the ashes are ready? It was against regulations, but Kerr nodded. He would keep the capsule of ashes in his locker until she came. It would be nice to see her again. She came weeks later for the ashes. There had been several battles of the bird people in the interval, and the pool in the tepidarium was full. As Kerr looked at her, he wondered how long it would be before she, too, was dead. He asked her new address. It was a fantastic distance away, in the worst part of the city, and after a little hesitation, he told her that if she could wait until his shift was over, he would be glad to walk back with her. She looked at him doubtfully. "It is most kind of you, but an Earthman was kind to us once. The children used to stone him." Kerr had never thought much about the position of the non-human races in his world. If it was unjust, if they were badly treated, he had thought it no more than a particular instance of the general cruelty and stupidity. Now, anger flared up in him. "That's all right," he said harshly, "if you don't mind waiting." Raisha smiled faintly. "No, I don't mind," she said. Since there were still some hours to go on his shift, he took her into a small reception room where there was a chaise lounge. "Try to sleep," he said. A little before 3, he came to rouse her, and found her lying quiet but awake. They left the bureau by a side door. The city was as quiet at this hour as it ever was. All the sign projectors and most of the streetlights had been turned off to save power, and even the vast, disembodied voices that boomed out of the air all day long and half the night were almost silent. The darkness and quiescence of the city made it seem easy for them to talk as they went through the streets. Kerr realized afterwards how confident he must have been of Raisha's sympathy to have spoken to her as freely as he did. And she must have felt an equal confidence in him, for after a little while, she was telling him fragments of her history and her people's past without reserve. "After the Earthmen took our planet," she said, "we had nothing left they wanted, but we had to have food. Then we discovered that they liked to watch us fight."
"You fought before the Earthmen came?" Kerr asked.
"Yes, but not as we fight now. It was a ritual then, very formal, with much politeness and courtesy. We did not fight to get things from each other, but to find out who was brave and who could give us leadership. The Earth people were impatient with our ritual. They wanted to see us hurting and being hurt. So we learned to fight as we fight now, hoping to be killed. There was a time when we first left our planet and went to the other worlds where people liked to watch us, when there were many of us. But there have been many battles since then. Now there are only a few left." At the cross street, a beggar slouched up to them. Kerr gave him a coin. The man was turning away with hands when he caught sight of Raisha's golden topknot. "Exty," he said in sudden rage. "Filth! And you, a man, going around with it? Here?" He threw the coin at Kerr.
"Even the beggars," Raisha said.
"Why is it, Kerr, you hate us so?"
"Because we have wronged you," he answered, and knew it was the truth.
"Are we always so unkind, though?"
"As the beggar was? Often it is worse."
"Raisha, you've got to get away from here."
"Where?" she answered simply.
"Our people have discussed it so many times. There is no planet on which there are not already billions of people from Earth. You increase so fast.
And besides, it doesn't matter. You don't need us. There isn't any place for us. We cared about that once, but not anymore. We're so tired, all of us, even the young ones like me. We're so tired of trying to live."
"You mustn't talk like that," Kerr said harshly. "I won't let you talk like that. You've got to go on. If we don't need you now, Raisha, we will." From the block ahead of them, there came the wan glow of a municipal telescreen. Late as the hour was, it was surrounded by a dense knot of spectators. Their eyes were fixed greedily on the combat that whirled dizzily over the screen. Raisha tugged gently at Kerr's sleeve.
"We had better go around," she said in a whisper. Kerr realized with a pang that there would be trouble if the viewer saw a man and an Extee together. Obediently, he turned. They had gone a block further when Kerr, for he had been thinking, said, "My people took the wrong road, Risha, about 200 years ago. That was when the council refused to accept, even in principle, any form of population control. By now we're stifling under the pressure of our own numbers, but we're crushed shapeless under it. Everything has had to give way to our one basic problem, how to feed an ever-increasing number of hungry mouths. Morality has dwindled into feeding ourselves, and we have the battle sports over the telecast to keep us occupied. But I think, I believe, that we'll get into the right road again sometime. I've read books of history, Risha. This isn't the first time we've chosen the wrong road. Someday there will be room for your people, Risha, if only..." He hesitated. "If only because you're so beautiful." He looked at her earnestly. Her face was remote and bleak. An idea came to him. "Have you ever heard anyone sing, Risha?" "Sing? No, I don't know the word." "Listen, then." He fumbled over his repertory and decided, through the music, was not really suited to his voice, on Tamino's song to Pamina's portrait. He sang it for her as they walked along. Little by little, Risha's face relaxed. "I like that," she said when the song was over. "Sing more, Kerr." "Do you see what I was trying to tell you?" he said at last, after many songs. "If we can make songs like that, Risha, isn't there hope for us?" "For you, perhaps. Not us," Risha answered. There was anger in her voice. "Stop it, Kerr. I do not want to be waked." But when they parted, she clasped hands with him and told him where they can meet again. "You are really our friend," she said. When he next met Risha, Kerr said, "I brought you a present. Here." He handed her a parcel. "And I've some news, too." Risha opened the little package. An exclamation of pleasure broke from her lips. "Oh, lovely! What a lovely thing! Where did you get it, Kerr?" "In a shop that sells old things, in the back." He did not tell her he had given 10 days' pay for the little turquoise locket. "But the stones are lighter than I realized. I wanted something that would be the color of your plumage." Risha shook her head. "No, this is the color it should be. This is right." She clasped the locket around her neck and looked down at it with pleasure. "And now, what is the news you have for me?" "A friend of mine is a clerk in the city records. He tells me a new planet, near Gamma Cassiopeiae, is being opened for colonization. I've filed the papers and everything is in order. The hearing will be held on Friday. I'm going to appear on behalf of the Nyir, your people, and ask that they be allotted space on the new world." Risha turned white. He started toward her, but she waved him away. One hand was still clasping her locket that was nearly the color of her plumage. The hearing was held in a small auditorium in the basement of the colonization building. Representatives of a dozen groups spoke before Kerr's turn came. "Appearing on behalf of the Nyir," the arbitrator read from a form in his hand, "S3687 Kerr. And who are the Nyir, S. Kerr? Some Indian group?" "No, sir," Kerr said. "They are commonly known as the bird people." "Oh, a conservationist." The arbitrator looked at Kerr not unkindly. "I'm sorry, but your petition is quite out of order. It should never have been filed. Immigration is restricted by executive order to terrestrials." Kerr dreaded telling Risha of his failure, but she took it with perfect calm. "After you left, I realized it was impossible," she said. "Risha, I want you to promise me something. I can't tell you how sure I am that humanity is going to need your people sometime." "It's true, Risha. I'm going to keep trying. I'm not going to give up." "Promise me this, Risha. Promise me that neither you nor the members of your group will take part in the battles until you hear from me again." Risha smiled. "All right, Kerr." Preserving the bodies of people who have died from a variety of diseases is not without its dangers. Kerr did not go to work that night, or the next, or for many nights. His dormitory chief, after listening to him shout in delirium for some hours, called a doctor, who filled out a hospital requisition slip. He was gravely ill, and his recovery was slow. It was nearly 5 weeks before he was released. He wanted above all things to find Raisha. He went to the place where she had been living and found that she had gone. No one knew where. In the end, he went to the identification bureau and begged for his old job there. Raisha would, he was sure, think of coming to the bureau to get in touch with him. He was still shaky and weak when he reported for work the next night. He went into the tepidarium about 9 o'clock during a routine inspection. And there, Raisha was. He did not know her for an instant. The lovely turquoise of her plumage had faded to a dirty drab. But the little locket he had given her was still around her neck. He got the big, jointed tongs they used for moving bodies out of the pool and put them in position. He lifted her out very gently and put her down on the edge of the pool. He opened the locket. There was a note inside. "Dear Care," he read in Rush's clear, handsome script, "you must forgive me for breaking my promise to you. They would not let me see you when you were sick, and we were all so hungry. Besides, you were wrong to think your people would ever need us. There is no place for us in your world. I wish I could have heard you sing again. I like to hear you sing. Raisha." Care looked from the note to Raisha's face and back at the note. It hurt too much. He did not want to realize that she was dead. Outside, one of the vast voices that boomed portentously down from the sky half the night long began to speak. "Don't miss the newest, fastest battle sport. View the Durga battles, the bloodiest combats ever televised. Funnier than the bird people's battles, more thrilling than an Andra war, you'll..." Care gave a cry. He ran to the window and closed it. He could still hear the voice, but it was all that he could do. The end.
Preset us on your radio.
Pick up country.
This message is brought to you by the Powell County Public Library. Although closed until further notice, the library staff are hard at work still providing innovative community programs for all ages. Like the Powell County Public Library's official Facebook page, where you can stay up to date with all library-related news, programs, and events. All checkout dates have been extended through the end of April, and all checked out materials should be kept home for the time being. With the library being closed, there will be no curbside service, no printing services, and no bookmobile service at this time. But you can still check out their online catalog by going to their website at pcplky.org to see everything their digital collection has to offer. For any questions, just send a message to the official Powell County Public Library Facebook page, and one of the available librarians will get in touch with you as soon as possible. The staff of the Powell County Public Library encourage you to stay healthy at home and practice social distancing methods to be a part of hashtag Team Kentucky and hashtag Together KY.
Hey, this is Lance Rogers. You can help stop the spread of respiratory diseases like COVID-19 by washing your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds, or by using a hand sanitizer with at least 60% alcohol content. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
This next story is a bit different, but is regarded as one of the best science fiction short stories of all time. Written by Harlan Ellison, author of nearly 1,000 short stories, essays, screenplays, and novels, and heralded as one of the cutting-edge writers of speculative fiction, this short story published in the 1960s is one of the award-winning works upon which his literary reputation was built. To put it simply, this story grows out of the tradition of revolt against social and political repression in literature. Its central character is the cocky, young rebel artist whom Ellison represented to the science fiction world in the 1960s, Harlan the Harlequin. This story is "Repent, Harlequin," said the Tick-Tock Man by Harlan Ellison. There are always those who ask, what is it all about? For those who need to ask, for those who need points sharply made, who need to know where it's at, this. The mass of men serve the state thus, not as men mainly, but as machines, with their bodies. They are the standing army, and the militia, jailers, constables, posse comitatus, etc. In most cases, there is no free exercise, whatever, of the judgment or of the moral sense. But they put themselves on a level with wood and earth and stones, and wooden men can perhaps be manufactured that will serve the purpose as well. Such command no more respect than men of straw or a lump of dirt. They have the same sort of worth only as horses and dogs. Yet, such as these even are commonly esteemed good citizens. Others, as most legislators, politicians, lawyers, ministers, and office holders, serve the state chiefly with their heads, and, as they rarely make any moral distinctions, they are as likely to serve the devil without intending it as God. A very few, as heroes, patriots, martyrs, reformers in the great sense, and men, serve the state with their consciences also, and so necessarily resist it for the most part, and they are commonly treated as enemies by it. Henry David Thoreau, Civil Disobedience. That is the heart of it. Now begin in the middle, and later learn the beginning. The end will take care of itself. But because it was the very world it was, the very world they had allowed it to become, for months his activities did not come to the alarmed attention of the ones who keep the machine functioning smoothly, the ones who poured the very best butter over the cams and mainsprings of the culture. Not until it had become obvious that somehow, some way, he had become a notoriety, a celebrity, perhaps even a hero for what officialdom inescapably tagged an emotionally disturbed segment of the populace, did they turn it over to the tick-tock man and his legal machinery. But by then, because it was the very world it was, and they had no way to predict he would happen, possibly a strain of disease long defunct, now suddenly reborn in a system where immunity had been forgotten, had lapsed. He had been allowed to become too real. Now he had form and substance. He had become a personality, something they had filtered out of the system many decades ago. But there it was, and there he was, a very definitely imposing personality. In certain circles, middle-class circles, it was thought disgusting, vulgar ostentation, anarchistic, shameful. In others, there was only sniggering, though strata where thought is subjugated to form and ritual, niceties, proprieties. But down below, down below, where the people always needed their saints and sinners, their bread and circuses, their heroes and villains, he was considered a Bolivar, a Napoleon, a Robin Hood, a Dick Bong, Ace of Aces, a Jesus, a Jomo Kenyatta. And at the top, where, like socially attuned shipwrecked Kellys, even tremor and vibration threatens to dislodge the wealthy, powerful, and titled from their flagpoles. He was considered a menace, a heretic, a rebel, a disgrace, a peril. He was known, down the line, to the very heart-meat core, but the important reactions were high above and far below. At the very top, at the very bottom. So his file was turned over, along with his time card and his cardio plate, to the office of the Tick-Tock Man. The Tick-Tock Man, very much over 6 feet tall, often silent, a soft, purring man when things went time-wise. The Tick-Tock Man. Even in the cubicles of the hierarchy, where fear was generated, seldom suffered, he was called the Tick-Tock Man. But no one called him that to his mask. You don't call a man a hated name. Not when that man, behind his mask, is capable of revoking the minutes, the hours, the days and nights, the years of your life. He was called the master timekeeper to his mask. It was safer that way. This is what he is, said the TikTok man with genuine softness. But not who he is. This time card I'm holding in my left hand has a name on it. But it is the name of what he is, not who he is. This cardio plate here in my right hand is also named, but not whom named,
merely what named. Before I can exercise proper revocation, I have to know who this what is. To his staff, all the ferrets, all the loggers, all the finks, all the comics, all the manees, he said, who is this harlequin? He was not purring smoothly. Time-wise, it was jangle. However, it was the longest speech they had ever heard him utter at one time. The staff, the ferrets, the loggers, the finks, the comics, but not the manees, who usually weren't around to know in any case. But even they scurried to find out. Who is the harlequin? High above the third level of the city, he crouched on the humming aluminum frame platform of the airboat. Foof! Airboat indeed! Swizzle kid is what it was, with a tow wreck jerry-rigged, and stared down at the neat Mondrian arrangement of the buildings. Somewhere nearby, he could hear the metronomic left-right-left of the 2:47 p.m. shift, entering the Timken roller-bearing plant in their sneakers. A minute later, precisely, he heard the softer right-left-right of the 5 o'clock a.m. formation going home. An elfish grin spread across his tanned features, and his dimples appeared for a moment. Then, scratching at his thatch of auburn hair, he shrugged within his motley, as though girding himself for what came next, and threw the joystick forward and bent into the wind as the airboat dropped. He skimmed over a slidewalk, purposely dropping a few feet to crease the tassels of the ladies of fashion, and, inserting thumbs and large ears, he stuck out his tongue, rolled his eyes, and went wugga wugga wugga. It was a minor diversion. One pedestrian skittered and tumbled, sending parcels every which way. Another wet herself. A third keeled slantwise, and the walk was stopped automatically by the servitors till she could be resuscitated. It was a minor diversion. Then he swirled away on a vagrant breeze and was gone. Hi-ho. As he rounded the cornice of the Time Motion Study building, he saw the shift just boarding the slidewalk. With practiced motion and an absolute conservation of movement, they sidestepped up onto the slow strip and, in a chorus line reminiscent of a Busby Berkeley film of the antediluvian 1930s, advanced across the strip's ostrich walking till they were lined up on the express trip. Once more, in anticipation, the elfin grin spread, and there was a tooth missing back there on the left side. He dipped, skimmed, and swooped over them, and then, scrunching about on the airboat, he released the holding pins that fastened shut the ends of the homemade pouring troughs that kept his cargo from dumping prematurely. And as he pulled the trough pins, the airboat slid over the factory workers and $150,000 worth of jelly beans cascaded down on the express trip. Jelly beans, millions and billions of purples and yellows and greens and licorice and grape and raspberry and mint and round and smooth and crunchy outside and soft mealy inside and sugary and bouncing, jouncing, tumbling, clittering, clattering, skittering, fell on the heads and shoulders and hard hats and carapaces of the Timken workers, tinkling on the sidewalk and bouncing away and rolling about underfoot, and filling the sky on their way down with all the colors of joy about underfoot, and filling the sky on the way down with all the colors of joy and childhood and holidays, coming down in a steady rain, a solid wash, a torrent of color and sweetness out of the sky from above, and entering a universe of sanity and metronomic order with quite mad cuckoo newness. Jelly beans! The shift workers howled and laughed and were pelted and broke ranks, and the jelly beans managed to work their way into the mechanism of the slidewalks, after which there was a hideous scraping as the sound of a million fingernails rasped down a quarter of a million blackboards, followed by a coughing and a sputtering, and then the slidewalks all stopped and everyone was dumped this-a-way and that-a-way in a jackstraw tumble, and still laughing and popping little jelly bean eggs of childish color into their mouths. It was a holiday, and a jollity, an absolute insanity, a giggle. But the shift was delayed 7 minutes. They did not get home for 7 minutes. the master's schedule was thrown off by 7 minutes. Quotas were delayed by inoperative sidewalks for 7 minutes. He had tapped the first domino in the line, and one after another, like chick, 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 the others had fallen. The system had been 7 minutes worth of disrupted. It was a tiny matter, one hardly worthy of note. But in a society where the single driving force was order and unity and promptness and clock-like precision and attention to the clock, reverence of the gods of the passage of time, it was a disaster of major importance. So, he was ordered to appear before the TikTok man. It was broadcast across every channel of the communications web. He was ordered to be there at 7 o'clock p.m. on time. And they waited. And they waited, but he didn't show up till almost 10:30, at which time he merely sang a little song about moonlight in a place no one had ever heard of, called Vermont, and vanished again. But they had all been wanting since 7, and it wrecked heck with their schedules. So the question remained, who is the Harlequin? But the unasked question, more important of the two, was, how did we get into this position, where a laughing, irresponsible japer of Jabberwocky and Jive could disrupt our entire economic and cultural life with $150,000 worth of jelly beans? Jelly, for God's sake, beans. This is madness. Where did he get the money to buy $150,000 worth of jelly beans? They knew it would have cost that much because they had a team of situation analysts pulled off another assignment and rushed to the slidewalk scene to sweep up and count the candies, and produce findings which disrupted their schedules and threw their entire branch at least a day behind. Jelly beans. Jelly beans? Now, wait a second. A second accounted for. No one has manufactured jelly beans for over 100 years. Where did he get jelly beans? That's another good question. More than likely, it will never be answered to your complete satisfaction. But then, how many questions ever are? And we'll be back with more after this.
Serving Powell, Estill, Montgomery, Clark, Lee, Bath, Menifee, Owsley, and Wolf counties.
Pickup Country.
Tune in on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9.
Online, live, or on demand at listenlikealocal.com.
With your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store, or on Apple Podcasts for the Pick Your Own Adventure series, where you and you alone are in charge of what happens in the journey. Danger, choice, adventure, and consequence. Are you prepared? The wrong decision could end a disaster, or worse. Live listeners can choose your path by texting WSKV in real time to 606-663-2811. The first text will control the next choice. Text 606-663-2811 during Pick Your Own Adventure and see how your stories unfold.
Hey, this is Aaron Boyd. The President's Guidelines for America remind you that even if you're young or otherwise, you're at risk, and your activities can increase the risk for others. It's so important that we all do our part to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Stay safe, Kentucky. This message is brought to you by Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.
The middle you know. Here is the beginning, how it starts. A desk pad. Day for day, and turn each day. 9 o'clock, open the mail. 9:45, appointment with planning commission board. 10:30, discuss installation progress charts with JL. 11:45, pray for rain. 12 o'clock, lunch. And so it goes. I'm sorry, Miss Grant, but the time for interviews was set at 2:30, and it's almost 5 now. I'm sorry you're late, but those are the rules. You'll have to wait till next year to submit application for this college again. And so it goes. The 10:10 local stops at Cresthaven, Galesville, Tonawanda Junction, Selby, and Farnhurst, but not at Indiana City, Lucasville, and Colton, except on Sunday. The 10:35 express stops at Galesville, Selby, and Indiana City, except on Sundays and holidays, at which time it stops at, and so it goes. I couldn't wait, Fred. I had to be at Pierre Cartain's by 3 o'clock, and you said you'd meet me under the clock in the terminal at 2:45. And you weren't there, so I had to go on. You're always late, Fred. If you'd been there, we could have sewed it up together. But as it was, well, I took the order alone.
And so it goes. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Atterley, in reference to your son Gerald's constant tardiness, I am afraid we will have to suspend him from school, unless some more reliable method can be instituted guaranteeing he will arrive at his classes on time. Granted, he is an exemplary student, and his marks are high. His constant flouting of the schedules of the school makes it impractical to maintain him in a system where the other children seem capable of getting where they are supposed to be on time. And so it goes. You cannot vote unless you appear at 8:45 a.m. I don't care if the script is good. I need it Thursday. Checkout time is 2 o'clock p.m. You got here late. The job's taken. Sorry. Your salary has been docked for 20 minutes time lost. God, what time is it? I've got to run. And so it goes. And so it goes, and so it goes, and so it goes, goes. Tick tock, tick tock, tick tock. And one day, we no longer let time serve us. We serve time, and we are slaves of the schedule, worshippers of the sun's passing, bound into a life predicted on restrictions, because the system will not function if we don't keep the schedule tight. Until it becomes more than a minor inconvenience to be late, it becomes a sin. Then a crime punishable by this. Effective 15 July, 2389, 12 a.m. midnight, the office of the Master Timekeeper will require all citizens to submit their time cards and cardio plates for processing. In accordance with Statute 5557SGH999, governing the revocation of time per capita, all cardio plates will be key to the individual holder, and what they had done was devise a method of curtailing the amount of life a person could have. If he was 10 minutes late, he lost 10 minutes of his life. An hour was proportionately worth more revocation. If someone was consistently tardy, he might find himself, on a Sunday night, receiving a communique from the master timekeeper that his time had run out and he would be turned off at high noon on Monday. Please straighten your affairs, sir. And so, by this simple scientific expedient, utilizing a scientific process held dearly secret by the TikTok man's office, the system was maintained. It was the only expedient thing to do. It was, after all, patriotic. The schedules had to be met. After all, there was a war on. But wasn't there always? Now that is really disgusting, the Harlequin said when Pretty Alice showed him the wanted poster. Disgusting and highly improbable. After all, this isn't the days of desperados. A wanted poster? You know, Alice noted, you speak with a great deal of inflection. I'm sorry, said the Harlequin humbly. No need to be sorry. You're always saying, I'm sorry. You have such massive guilt, Everett. It's really very sad. I'm sorry, he repeated, then pursed his lips so the dimples appeared momentarily. He hadn't wanted to say that at all. I have to go out again. I have to do something. Alice slammed her coffee bulb down on the counter. Oh, for God's sake, Everett, can't you stay home just one night? Must you always be out in that ghastly clown suit running around annoying people? He stopped and clapped the jester's hat onto his auburn thatch, which a tiny tingling of bells. He rose, rinsed out his coffee bowl by the tap, and put it into the dryer for a moment. I have to go. She didn't answer. The fax box was purring, and she pulled a sheet out, read it, threw it toward him on the counter. It's about you, of course. You're ridiculous. He read it quickly. It said the TikTok man was trying to locate him. He didn't care. He was going out to be late again. At the door, dredging for an exit line, he hurled back petulantly, "Well, you speak with inflection, too." Alice rolled her pretty eyes heavenward. "You're ridiculous." The Harlequin stalked out, slamming the door, which sighed shut softly and locked itself. There was a gentle knock, and Alice got up with an exhalation and an exasperated breath and opened the door. He stood there. I'll be back about 10:30, okay? She pulled a rueful face. Why do you tell me that? Why? You know you'll be late. You know it. You're always late. So why do you tell me these dumb things? She closed the door. On the other side, the Harlequin nodded to himself. She's right. She's always right. I'll be late. I'm always late. Why do I tell her these dumb things? He shrugged again and went off to be late once more. He had fired off the firecracker rockets that said, I will attend the 115th Annual International Medical Association invocation at 8 o'clock p.m., precisely. I do hope you will be able to join me. The words had burned in the sky, and of course the authorities were there, lying in wait for him. They assumed, naturally, that he would be late. He arrived 20 minutes early, while they were setting up the spider webs to trap and hold him. And blowing a large bullhorn, he frightened and unnerved them so. Their own moisturized encirclement webs sucked close, and they were hauled up, kicking and shrieking, high above the amphitheater's floor. The Harlequin laughed and laughed and apologized profusely. The physicians, gathered in solemn conclave, roared with laughter and accepted the Harlequin's apologies with exaggerated bowing and posturing, and a merry time was had by all. Who thought the Harlequin was a regular foo-for-raw in fancy pants? All, that is, but the authorities, who had been sent out by the office of the TikTok man, who hung there like so much dockside cargo, hauled up above the floor of the amphitheater in a most unseemly fashion. In another part of the same city, where the Harlequin carried on his activities, totally unrelated in every way to what concerns here, save that it illustrates the TikTok man's power and import, a man named Marshall Delahanty received his turnoff notice from the TikTok man's office. His wife received the notification from the gray-suited Manet who delivered it, with the traditional look of sorrow plastered hideously across his face. She knew what it was, even without unsealing it. It was a billet doux of immediate recognition to everyone these days. She gasped and held it as though it were a glass slide tinged with botulism, and prayed it was not for her. Let it be for Marsh, she thought, brutally, realistically, or one of the kids, but not for me, please, dear God, not for me. And then she opened it, and it was for Marsh. And she was at one and the same time, horrified and relieved. The next trooper in the line had caught the bullet. Marshall, she screamed. Marshall, termination, Marshall, oh my God, Marshall, what'll we do, what'll we do, Marshall. And in their home that night was the sound of tearing paper and fear. And the stink of madness went up the flue, and there was nothing, absolutely nothing, they could do about it. But Marshall Delahanty tried to run, and early the next day, when turn-off time came, he was deep in the forest 200 miles away, and the office of the TikTok man blanked his cardio plate, and Marshall Delahanty keeled over, running, and his heart stopped, and the blood dried up on its way to his brain, and he was dead, that's all. One light went out on his sector map in the office of the master timekeeper, while notification was entered for fax reproduction, and Georgette Delahanty's name was entered on the dole rolls till she could remarry. Which is the end of the footnote, and all the point that need be made, except don't laugh, because that is what would happen to the Harlequin if ever the TikTok man found out his real name. It isn't funny. The shopping level of the city was thronged with the Thursday colors of the buyers. Women in canary yellow chitones and men in pseudo-Tylorian outfits that were jade and leather and fit very tightly, save for the balloon pants. When the Harlequin appeared on the still-being-constructed shell of New Efficiency Shopping Center, his bullhorn to his elfishly laughing lips, everyone pointed and stared, and he berated them. Why let them order you about? Why let them tell you to hurry and scurry like ants or maggots? Take your time. Saunter a while. Enjoy the sunshine. Enjoy the breeze. Let life carry you at your own pace. Don't be slaves of time. It's a hell of a way to die, slowly, by degrees. Down with the TikTok man. Who's the nut? Most of the shoppers wanted to know. Who's the nut? Oh, wow, I'm going to be late. I gotta run. And with that, we'll continue with the story next week. Thank you so much for joining us tonight for our Pick Me a Story series, right here on your hometown station, Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV. If you missed tonight's segment, you can always listen on demand at listenlikealocal.com with your mobile app from the Google Play or App Store and on Apple Podcast.
If you enjoyed tonight's show, be sure to tune in next Thursday at 6 o'clock p.m. right here on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV and join me for the next installment of Pick Me a Story. My name is Kelly Ward and I'm the Teen and Adult Services Librarian at the Powell County Public Library, and it's my pleasure to share stories with the community during this time when we should all be staying healthy at home and practicing social distancing methods. If you have any recommendations for what books we should explore next, just send me an email at kward@pcplky.org. That's kward@pcplky.org. Don't forget to tune in next week on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV, online at listenlikealocal.com, or with the free WSKV app for our next installment of Pick Me a Story. Be safe and have a wonderful rest of your evening.
We hope you get stuck on Pickup Country 104.9 WSKV.